Rediscover God's Word, verse by verse, chapter by chapter. This is Real Bible Study with teacher Tom Bradford. Welcome to Torah Class.
In this second chapter of Joel, we witness the beauty and the justice of Yehovah that's on display. Severe wrath for Judah's rebellion, for their treason against him. Extreme mercy, outpouring of blessings for their obedience and for their sincere repentance. Now, this fact is revealed in that Joel chapter 2 is divided into two distinct halves, each reflecting one side of the coin of God's divine character. The first half continues through verse 17, and it's about an enemy army invading and decimating Judah for their insistent long-term rebellion against Yehovah. The second half begins in verse 18 with Yehovah turning the tide, restoring Judah, and instead punishing the nations for their maltreatment of Judah and of Israel. Each of these events are marked as a day of Yehovah, a day of the Lord. Now, there are several. It's not just one. Days of Yehovah, days of the Lord. The fall of the northern kingdom of Ephraim, Israel, in 723 BC, that was one. The invasion and exile of the southern kingdom of Judah in 586 BC, that was another. The coming of Christ actually represents another day of Yehovah of an unusual type, when God's wrath was rained down upon one person in payment for the sins of all. And Yeshua's second coming will be yet another, also of a unique type. Now, arguably, there are at least a couple more that, while not technically labeled as a day of Yehovah, in effect and force, they are, such as the invasion of Canaan by Israel, as led by Joshua, and centuries later, the Roman invasion of Jerusalem when the temple was destroyed in 70 AD. Now, Joel is certainly not the first prophet to speak of these things, nor is he the last. One of the other such prophets is Zechariah. You know, I think prophecy is perhaps a most difficult challenge to understand because it can be so cryptic, so complex. So it helps us to better understand Joel's words when we add in some of what the other prophets said about the same events and then what leads up to them. And as concerns Israel's merciful restoration after the several days of Yehovah events that have targeted Israel for God's wrath, here is a passage from Zechariah that fleshes out what Joel's prophecy beginning in verse 18, chapter 2, verse 18, has to say about it. So in Zechariah, first chapter of Zechariah 12 through 17, we read, "The angel of Adonai said, Adonai Sefaot, how long will you keep withholding mercy from Jerusalem and from the cities of Judah? Well, you've been angry with them for the past 70 years. And Adonai replied with kind and comforting words to the angel who was speaking with me. And the angel speaking with me then said to me, here is what Adonai Sefaot says. He says, I am extremely jealous on behalf of Jerusalem and Zion. And to the same degree, I'm extremely angry with the nations that are so self-satisfied. Because I was only a little angry at Jerusalem and Zion, but they made the suffering worse. Therefore, Adonai says, I will return to Jerusalem with merciful deeds. My house will be rebuilt there, says Adonai Sefaot. Yes, a measuring line will be stretched out over Jerusalem. And in addition, proclaim that Adonai Zevaot says, my cities will again overflow with prosperity. Adonai will again comfort Zion, and he will again make Jerusalem the city of his choice. Now, Zechariah prophesied around 520 BC. That is, he wrote going on 70 years after Babylon had invaded Judah and exiled the people, and just before the Persians released Judah to go back home. And a few more years before Ezra and Nehemiah would take on the task of rebuilding the temple. Now, in relation to Joel, then, Zechariah probably prophesied around 250 years later, after what we're reading in Joel's book. Now, the theme in this portion of Zechariah is pleading with God to fulfill the already given prophecy that Yehovah would restore Judah, because as of yet, it had not happened. Now, what I want to highlight is the very great degree of God's jealousy and care for Judah and Jerusalem, the people, the land, and the temple. And conversely, in the same passage, the Lord declares his building anger with the nations, meaning Gentile nations, who simply made Israel's misery worse. Now, the point and principle of this pronouncement applies to us in the modern age as much as it did to the nations in the 6th century BC. It also applies especially to the Constantinian church, the modern-day church, that has claimed for 1,600 years that it is the representative assembly of believers that Yeshua began. Yet I would assert that claim needs to be reexamined. Why do I make such a strong statement and claim as this? It's because of the truth. It's because the alarm must be sounded, even though so many will turn a deaf ear and respond just as the residents and the leaders of Judah and earlier in Ephraim, Israel, just as they did that we read about in Hosea, Amos, and Joel. They too sincerely believed that their man-made doctrines had become the new truth, and that God's actual word was a little less important, or parts of it relevant, not very relevant for them. Now, the foundational principles of the modern church turn on what we're reading in Joel and in the other prophets I have quoted in our study. It turns all that on its head. Constantinian Christianity is based on the belief that Israel's restoration blessings have been turned over to Gentile Christians, that Israel has permanently lost favor with God, and that along with that loss of favor, the entire justice system, all of the moral code Yehovah set down for them, the law of Moses, has also been rescinded. Now, unwittingly, I suspect, Christians have in general become accomplices with the nations in their poor treatment of Israel, even though admittedly a portion of the church at least has decided to be friendly towards Israel in some ways. Over and over in the Bible, we read of God's great jealousy, of his great concern and care and favor for Judah, for Jerusalem. We read of the promise that he would not only restore them, but also that those blessings would overflow like never before. Even more, that the seat of heavenly government from which Yeshua will eventually rule and reign will be in Zion, that is, Jerusalem. Now, what we read, not only in the New Testament, in the Old Testament, but also in the New, is that in the end, the nations and those people that stand with those governments in their disfavor and maltreatment of Israel, they are going to receive God's angry wrath. I mean, church, if you're listening, do you seriously believe that the claim of faith in Jesus exempts you from that promise of God to punish those who join in the maltreatment of his chosen people? Seriously? I mean, how can you know whose side you stand with, how God judges on this matter? Read the prophets. The prophets make it abundantly clear that for people of the 21st century, our stance on two issues is the best indicator of whether we're on God's side or we're not. Do you insist that the Jews must give up their Jewishness in order to join the assembly of believers who follow Yeshua? Do you support the idea of a two-state solution or any political resolution to the status of the Holy Land that might evolve that proposes to divide the land and give a portion of it to Israel's enemies, those who worship a false god? Well, if you do, guess what? You stand with the nations. And you're going to be judged according to that stance. And you're going to suffer what the nations are going to suffer. So if you believe what Joel and Zechariah and others are telling all who care to read and hear, then the next dilemma that so many is going to face is, what are you going to do about it? Do you intend to stay and fight for reform within your particular denomination, or will you separate yourself from it and seek a congregation that wants to acknowledge God's word as true and relevant from Genesis to Revelation? What are you going to do? My advice is that unless you are a highly placed leader with enough influence to make reforming within your denomination even remotely possible, God tells the rest of us something for so very, very simple, so straightforward. Revelation, not an ancient, one of the more ancient prophecies, but Revelation chapter 18, starting at verse 1. After all these things, I saw another angel coming down from heaven, and he had great authority, and the earth was lit up by his splendor. And he cried out in a strong voice, "She has fallen. She has fallen, Babel the Great. She's become a house for demons, a prison for every unclean spirit, a prison for every unclean hated bird. For all the nations have drunk of the wine of God's fury caused by her whoring. Yes, the kings of the earth went whoring after, went whoring with her. And from her unrestrained love of luxury, the world's businessmen have grown rich." Then I heard another voice out of heaven say, "My people, come out of her so that you will not share in her sins, so that you will not be infected by her plagues, because her sins are a sticky mass piled up to heaven and God has remembered her crimes." So my plea to you, I think God's instruction to you through his prophets, is one of self-preservation. If and when we finally recognize that what our place of worship might actually stand for is not what God says we're supposed to do, then we're not admonished to stay and fight. Rather, come out of her, my people. Run, flee. Get as far away from it as you can. Don't look back. Don't become as Lot's wife. Separate yourself and then seek the ancient biblical faith as Moses, the prophets, Yeshua, the apostles taught. And as I feel so strongly that at this point in human history, we have stepped over, or at least we stand upon, the threshold of the end times, it pays to remember something that's really so painful to admit. It is that it has been recognized for centuries by various church leaders that at least some part of the Christian world is going to be reckoned by God as members of the symbolic Babylon of the book of Revelation. Despite their insistence, they are not. And those members will share in God's wrath. Some professed believers, who knows how many, are most definitely going to be left behind, as Tim LaHaye's novel so deftly presents. Yeshua warns about this in the most dramatic of ways. Matthew chapter 7, starting at verse 20. So you will recognize them by their fruit. Does he say by what they'll say? By what they'll profess? You will recognize them by their fruit. Not everyone who says to me, Lord, Lord, will enter the kingdom of heaven. Only those who do what my Father in heaven wants. On that day, many are going to say to me, Lord, Lord, didn't we prophesy in your name? Didn't we expel demons in your name? Didn't we perform miracles in your name? Then I'll tell them to their faces, I never knew you. Get away from me, you workers of lawlessness. So everyone who hears these words of mine and acts on them will be like a sensible man who built his house on bedrock. The rains fell, the rivers flooded, the winds blew, beat against that house. It didn't collapse because its foundation was on rock. But everyone who hears these words of mine and does not act on them will be like a stupid man who built his house on sand. Oof. Just as Joel and the other prophets are speaking candidly only to those who believe in Yehovah, God of Israel, can't we see that Jesus is talking only to those who openly claim belief in him? That's all he's talking to here. Who else than those who say they follow Yeshua would prophesy, which, by the way, in that era meant to teach, to prophesy in his name? Who else? But he doesn't stop there. He says that upon coming to understand what it is he's teaching, next there must be a transfer from inner belief to outward action. Those who do not take concrete action are described by him as those who are stupid. Because even though they know the truth, they continue to depend on false doctrines, which he calls a foundation of sand, to deliver them. Doctrines that are not the truth. The finger pointing as to just who the book of Revelation's symbolic Babylon is, and therefore who these particular believers are that Christ considers as not accepted by him, is usually aimed towards Catholicism. Yet this is so very hypocritical, because the reality is 95% of foundational Protestant-based doctrines are Catholic doctrines. The main difference, I would say, is that the Catholics have a pope and Mary worship as part of their tradition, but the underlying anti-Semitism, the built-in bias against the Jewish people, the explicit insistence that the Jews are cursed and their blessings have been transferred to Gentiles, and that the Jews operate under one divine justice system, Gentiles under another, this has all been thoroughly carried forward into the bulk of Protestant and Orthodox-based Christianity, even if often this is subtle. It's not necessarily spoken out too loudly from the pulpit. God's oracle to Joel is, historically speaking, about Israelites who claim they are God's people, but they behave and believe quite differently from God's scriptural instructions to them. Now, unfortunately, the majority of them would not take this warning seriously. They even fought against those who attempted to return to the true faith. I mean, I can't stress enough. This applies to us today. Just as much as it did to the ancient Israelites, because that's how biblical prophecy works. I mean, one of the reasons for Torah class, undertaking the study of all 12 minor prophets in depth, is to become more aware of our predicament, to stop being stupid, as Yeshua warned. So as we continue in Joel, just place yourself as among those the good prophet is speaking to, because you are. As they say, if the shoe fits, wear it. Okay, let's reread part of Joel chapter 2. Joel chapter 2. We're going to start reading at verse 18. Then Adonai will become jealous for his land and have pity on his people. Here is how Adonai will answer his people. I will send you grain, wine, and olive oil, enough to satisfy you, and no longer will I make you a mockery among the goyim, among the Gentile nations. No, I will take the northerner away, far away from you, and drive him to a land that is waste and barren, with his vanguard towards the eastern sea, his rear guard towards the western sea. His stench, his rottenness will rise because he has done great things. Don't fear, O soil. Be glad. Rejoice, for Adonai has done great things. Don't be afraid, wild animals, for the desert pastures are green. The trees are putting out their fruit. The fig tree and the vine are giving full yield. Be glad, people of Zion. Rejoice in Adonai your God, for he is giving you the right amount of rain in the fall. He makes the rain come down for you, the fall and spring rains. This is what he does first. Then the floors will be full of grain, the vats overflow with wine and olive oil. I will restore to you the years that the locusts ate, the grasshoppers, shearer worms, cutter worms, my great army that I sent against you. You will eat until you're satisfied, and you will praise the name of Adonai your God, who has done with you such wonders. Then my people will never again be ashamed. You will know that I am with Israel, that I am Adonai your God, and that there is no other. Then my people will never again be shamed. Now, God's oracle is phrased in such a way that we are to understand that the compassion and mercy he's going to have at a future time upon Judah and Jerusalem is based upon the positive response of the priests who are told to stand at their posts and to pray for mercy. Now, nearly all English versions have the verb tenses stated incorrectly. See, the syntax of the original Hebrew requires that we take the imperfect, the incomplete tense, when coupled with what's called the vav consecutive form, as making the described action as something that has already happened. In other words, this passage ought to read not as something that, oh, it will eventually happen, but as something that has already been decided. It's a done deal in heaven. Thus, in spiritual terms, it's already occurred. So this is how we ought to read Joel 2:18. Then was the Lord jealous for his land, and he had pity on his people. See the difference? So what Joel is saying is that as of the moment that he speaks, Joel speaks this prophecy, the process of fulfilling it begins. This allows me to remind you of an important principle of biblical prophecy in general, which is, whatever God has decided in heaven, it is brought into this physical world and set into motion upon his prophets speaking it. That's how it works. Whatever then comes later, after the prophecy is delivered by a prophet, it's then just a long series of events that are designed to move the ball forward in order for this prophecy to reach its fullest fulfillment in our physical world. The promise that God makes to Judah includes this ongoing balance or connectedness of the people with the land. One without the other is incomplete. God sees the land of Israel and the people of Israel as an organic unity. Thus, in God's wrath, when Israel is removed from the land quits producing. But in verse 19, the restoration of Israel, the land begins again to produce abundantly, if not miraculously. One of the several reasons that I insist all believers need to make at least one pilgrimage to Israel is to personally see this land so amazingly productive as proof of the literalness of God's prophecies and fulfillments. Prior to Israel's return in the mid-20th century, the land they formerly lived in had become largely a denuded wasteland. Millions of trees had been chopped down because the Arab absentee landlords had imposed a tree tax on the migrant Arabs and Bedouins that had moved into the area. So the migrants destroyed the trees in order to avoid having to pay the tax. The fertile Hula Valley in the north had become little more than a mosquito-infested swampland. The area surrounding the Galilee was just rocks and weeds. The deserts were barren and sterile. But today, all that's changed, and Israel has again become a net exporter of produce that ranks among the finest anywhere. This new reality for Israel is that they will no longer be a reproach. They won't be a laughingstock of the nations anymore. Rather, they will become envied, which indeed has happened. Of course, along with envy comes jealousy and recriminations from those who hate Israel or they deny the concept of Israel as a set-apart and specially blessed people. Now, the source of this jealousy and recrimination is embodied in verse 20 when it speaks about the northern nation or nations, enemies of Israel, that God is going to drive, he says, into a waterless desert. Now, is this speaking of a specific nation? Probably not, because Israel is bordered on the Mediterranean, by the Mediterranean on the west, and desert to the east, and then invasions, because of that, invasions almost always came then from the north. Obviously, the invasions of Assyria and Babylon came from the north. The prophets Jeremiah and Ezekiel in particular speak of invaders coming from the north. Ezekiel 38:1, the word of Adonai came to me, human being, turn your face towards Gog of the land of Magog, chief prince of Meshech and Tuval, and prophesy against him. Say that Adonai Elohim says, I'm against you, Gog, chief prince of Meshech and Tuval. I will turn you around, put hooks in your jaws, bring you out with all your army and horses and horsemen, all completely equipped with a great horde, with breastplates and shields, all wielding swords. Parash, Ethiopia, and Put are with them, all with breastplates and helmets. Gomer with all its troops, the house of Togarmah, in the reaches far to the north, with all its troops, many peoples are with you. Jeremiah, chapter 1, starting with verse 13. A second time the word of Adonai came to me asking, what do you see? And I answered, I see a cauldron tilted away from the north over a fire fanned by the wind. And Adonai said to me, from the north calamity will boil over unto everyone living in the land. Because I will summon all the families in the kingdoms of the north, says Adonai, and they will come and sit, each one on his throne at the entrance to the gates of Jerusalem, opposite its walls, all the way around, opposite all the cities of Judah. I will pronounce my judgment against them for all their wickedness and abandoning me, offering incense to other gods, worshiping what their own hands made. Now, there's other mentions in the Bible of nations and armies coming from the north, but getting too specific about identifying in modern terms who these are in our day is probably just too big of a reach, much too speculative to attempt it. Here in Joel, the term the northerners or the northern one is more of a generalized parallel term for any invader. Since invaders of Israel and Judah, for geographical reasons, almost always come from the north. And so we're told that it will be the same for the final holy war battle of Armageddon. Now God says that the enemy will be forced into the eastern and western seas, and the odor of the decomposition of the countless bodies of the dead enemy soldiers will ascend up to God, just as the odor of the corruption of those northern nations ascended up to God. Now, the final phrase in this verse, for it has done great things, that's a bit puzzling. Who or what is it that has done such great things? Well, probably because this passage has Israel being encouraged to rejoice over the turn of events to their favor, then we must assign the great things spoken of not to an it, but rather to Yehovah God. So the idea is that Yehovah's destruction of the invaders from the north is due to their corruption, and this destruction must be at God's direct hand, because only he could bring about such a great thing. In fact, verses 21 through 23 act together in a call to rejoice. And within those verses, Joel summons the earth, the domestic and wild animals, and the people of Judah to praise God for what he has done on their behalf. We've read how terribly the soil suffered because of the locust invasion and the drought. The various wild and domestic beasts of the field suffered because the plants and grasses they fed on had been destroyed. The people suffered because of the twin disasters of the locusts and the drought, just as the land, the animals, and the people suffer together, so do they rejoice together when the land is bountiful and their shalom is restored. Now, verse 23 is actually a bit controversial. Most Bibles interpret the Hebrew of this verse as speaking about rain. However, some versions instead translate the Hebrew intent not as rain, but rather as speaking about a teacher. The word in question in Hebrew is moreh, and it can legitimately be translated as both rain and as teacher. Now, I want to compare a couple of different Bible versions for you. In the Complete Jewish Bible, in Joel 2:23, we read, "Be glad, people of Zion, rejoice in Adonai your God, for he is giving you the right amount of rain in the fall. He makes the rain come down for you, the fall and spring rains." This is what he does first. In the Young's literal translation, it reads, "And ye sons of Zion, joy and rejoice in Jehovah your God, for he hath given to you the teacher for righteousness, and causeth to come down to you a shower, sprinkling, and gathered in the beginning." So in one case, it's rain that comes down from above. In another case, it's the teacher of righteousness. Now, it's interesting that in the Qumran Dead Sea Scrolls, their society, they predicted that in the end times, there would be a coming teacher of righteousness. Where'd they get that notion from? Now, on the surface, one might think the Dead Sea Scroll writers, the Essenes, took their cue from here in Joel and from Hosea which use the same word in a similar way. But truth is, there's no document of the Essenes saying that's where they got the idea from. So it's very hard to know exactly where their interpretation of a teacher of righteousness emerged, or if it came from their own minds, or maybe it was a godly inspiration. Nonetheless, in the Qumran Dead Sea Scrolls documents, the mention of a teacher of righteousness is a central character. And sometimes it is connected to the advent of a Messiah. Now, most commentators believe this is speaking about rain, not a teacher, because either we read about the drought, because earlier we read about the drought conditions that are now being reversed. It is that since Joel speaks of both, well, let me back up. I think there's a third possibility that well reflects the underlying dynamic of most prophecy, really. It is that since Joel speaks of both spiritual and material blessings ahead for Judah, that it may be that we need to render the word more as the teacher of righteousness in the first part of the verse, and then later in that same verse, that same word is meant to address actual watery rain. That is, the spiritual blessings of Messiah first, then later, the material blessings of the rain upon the soil. Now, I don't want to spend any more time with this because the meaning is just too ambiguous for me to get too rigid about it, but that's what I think. Now, verse 24 is almost the same as verse 19 when it speaks of the land producing abundantly. The three standard household staples of grain, juice from the grape, wine, and olive oil. They're all addressed. And then in the following verse, it is most interestingly expressed as this new abundance being, but repayment, catch this, being repayment for the years of scarcity that the four locust attacks caused. Interesting. The repayment is a recompense to the people for their suffering, so to speak. We get a very similar thought from the book of Leviticus, when a list of curses against Israel for not obeying God is given. But this particular one, however, speaks of a payback in terms of benefiting the land, as opposed to the people, although because the land and the people are organically connected, then of course the people will also benefit. But listen to this, this is interesting. Leviticus 26, 31 to 35. I will lay waste to your cities and make your sanctuaries desolate so as not to smell your fragrant aromas. I will desolate the land so that your enemies living in it will be astounded by it. You I will disperse among the nations, and I will draw out the sword in pursuit after you. Your land will be a desolation and your cities a wasteland. Then at last, the land will be paid its Shabbats. And as long as it lies desolate and you are in the lands of your enemies, the land will rest and it will be paid its Shabbats. Yes, as long as it lies desolate, it will have rest. The rest it did not have during your Shabbats when you lived there. Okay. Basically, Leviticus is saying that one of the reasons that Israel will be ejected from the land will be because they ignored the seven-year cycles of Sabbath years. That is, according to the law of Moses, the land is to be worked, planted, harvested for six consecutive years. But in the seventh year, it's to lie fallow, thereby giving the land a Sabbath rest. Therefore, with Israel in exile, the land, ironically enough, in this way gets repaid the years of Sabbath year rest it should have had, but it didn't get. because of Israel's disobedience. Kind of interesting. See, the thing to notice is, again, however, how connected the people of Israel are to the land of Israel. So the first half of verse 26 now is fairly straightforward. The restoration of blessings shall be so startling, seemingly impossible, that the people will spontaneously just burst out in praise to God in what is nothing less than a full reorientation from their former ways of unfaithfulness to obedience and righteousness. The final words of the verse, however, aren't as clear-cut as the, frankly, as the number of ways this winds up being translated into English demonstrates. Whereas the complete Jewish Bible says, when my people will never again be ashamed, the King James Version says, when my people shall never again be ashamed, and the Young's literal translation says, and not ashamed are my people to the age. See, the difference lies in just how long of a period of time after God restores these blessings might these blessings continue unabated. One version makes it forever. Another is indefinite, could be for any length of time. And yet a third puts it in terms of not being ashamed throughout what's called the present age. The issue is this. If never again, or through the end of the present age, are what is being envisioned, then this verse has to be speaking of the future and final end times event. If not, then it could be speaking of something that lasts just for a while, with another fulfillment of it coming later still. If it's about the end times, then we again have a conflation of Joel seeing prophetic fulfillments both in the near and in the far future times. I think this is exactly that. Judah will return from their Babylonian exile, and the land will flourish again. They will be allowed to stay in the land from around 500 BC to 70 AD, when the Romans will dispossess and exile them on God's behalf. Then the land will again stop producing. Israel will not be allowed back into the land until the year 1948, when the modern state of Israel was reborn, after which time they will never again be dispossessed and exiled. And this is that forever promise. Now Ezekiel speaks eloquently about that time of the forever promise that we are living in right now. Right now. The proof of which is the return first of Judah, the Jews, to the land after the Roman exile from 1900 years ago. And lately, in the 21st century, the return of Ephraim, Israel, also known as the 10 lost tribes, to the land from their Assyrian exile of 2,700 years ago. Pull out your Bibles. I'd like you to follow along with me as we read Ezekiel 37. I like to read this about every other week. This is a great, great prophecy. Ezekiel chapter 37. Follow along. With the hand of Adonai upon me, Adonai carried me out by his spirit and set me down in the middle of the valley, and it was full of bones. And he had me pass by all around them, and there were so many bones lying in the valley, and they were so dry. And he asked me, human being, can these bones live? And I answered, Adonai, Elohim, only you know that. And then he said to me, prophesy over these bones and say to them, dry bones, hear what Adonai has to say. To these bones, Adonai Elohim says, I'll make breath enter you. You'll be alive. I'll attach ligaments to you. I'm going to make flesh grow on you, cover you with skin, put breath in you. You will live, and you will know that I'm Adonai. So I prophesied as ordered, And while I was prophesying, there was a noise, a rattling sound. It was the bones coming together, each bone in its proper place. And as I watched, ligaments grew on them, flesh appeared, skin covered them, but there was no breath in them. So next he said to me, prophesy to the breath. Prophesy, human being, say to the breath that Adonai Elohim says, come from the four winds. Breathe. Breathe on these slain so that they can live. So I prophesied as ordered, and the breath came into them, and they were alive, and they stood up on their feet, a huge army. And then he said to me, human being, these bones are the whole house of Israel. And they are saying, our bones have dried up, our hope's gone, we're completely cut off. Therefore prophesy and say to them that Adonai Elohim says, my people, I will open your graves and make you get up out of your graves, and I will bring you to the land of Israel. Then you will know that I'm Adonai when I've opened your graves and made you get up out of your graves, my people. I will put my spirit in you. You will be alive. Then I will place you on your own land, and you will know that I, Adonai, have spoken. I have done it, says Adonai. The word of Adonai came to me. You, human being, take one stick and write on it for Judah, for those joined with him among the people of Israel. Take another stick and write on it for Joseph, the stick of Ephraim, and all the house of Israel are joined with him. Finally, bring them together into a single stick so they become one in your hand. And when your people ask you what all this means, tell them that Adonai Elohim says, I will take the stick of Joseph, which is in the hand of Ephraim, together with the tribes of Israel who are joined with him, and put them together with the stick of Judah and make them a single stick so that they become one in my hand. The sticks on which you write are to be in your hand as they watch. And then say to him that Adonai Elohim says, I will take the people of Israel from all the nations where they've gone. I will gather them from every side, bring them back to their own land. I will make them one nation in the land, on the mountains of Israel, and one king will be king for all of them. They will no longer be two nations. They will never again be divided into two kingdoms. They will never again defile themselves with their idols, their detestable things, or any of their transgressions, but I will save them from all the places where they've been living and sinning. I will cleanse them so that they will be my people and I'll be their God. My servant David will be king over them. All of them will have one shepherd. They will live by my rulings, keep and observe my regulations. They will live in the land I gave to Jacob, my servant, where your ancestors lived. They will live there. They, their children, their grandchildren, forever. David, my servant, will be their leader forever. I will make a covenant of peace with them, an everlasting covenant. I will give to them, increase their numbers, set my sanctuary among them forever. My home will be with them. I will be their God. They will be my people. The nations will know that I'm Adonai, who sets Israel apart as holy when my sanctuary is with them forever. You know, Joel and Ezekiel line up perfectly. With Ezekiel essentially greatly expanding on Joel. Since what Ezekiel has described has never happened before in history, but is happening now, today, in modern Israel, then what we're witnessing with our own eyes is what Ezekiel and Joel were speaking about. We are assured that now that all the tribes are returning and the land is nearly entirely back under Israel's possession, they will never again be ejected from it by God. And the only way that each time in history they were invaded and ejected was because God led certain nations to do so. Because otherwise, no nation or empire could possibly succeed in ejecting them, since Jehovah was their protector and he can't be defeated. See, this is something that both Israel and those followers of Yeshua who love Israel can rest easy about. However, much too much of the modern church once Israel ejected from parts of the land, especially from the West Bank, what at one time was called Samaria. They want half of Jerusalem removed from the Jews, given over to the Arab Palestinians in concession to the demands of Muslims the world over, believing that this is the fair and the just road to a lasting Middle East peace. Well, the greater part of Jews in America, about half the Jews in Israel, they want this to happen as well. I want all to please hear me on this. Just remember that the word Palestinians is but the Greek translation of the Hebrew word Pelishtim, which in English is Philistines. The Roman emperor that destroyed the temple renamed it in order to heap shame upon the Jews. That is, he renamed Israel to that of their staunch historical enemy, Philistia. Therefore, any time or event from the destruction of the temple on back into prior history cannot be what the second half of Joel 2:26 is speaking about, nor what Ezekiel 37 is describing. Can't be. However, since 1948, we have entered that time frame, and we're so very privileged to live in such a time as this. The ancient prophets would have given anything to see. Verse 27 completes chapter 2 with the words that because of what Jehovah has done, then Israel will know that he indeed is their God and there is no other to turn to. And it repeats the promise that Israel will never again be held in shame for having been kicked out from their own land by their own God. Well, the next chapter of Joel, chapter 3, begins with some words that explain that God's several interventions in the history and in the fate of Israel and the world are anything but on hold. Those words are, after this. So next week, we'll study Joel chapter 3 and find out what exciting things happen after this.
For more teachings of real Bible study and to rediscover God's Word with Tom Bradford, visit Torah Class today on the web, streaming TV, or download the Torah Class mobile app.